All right. We're still on biogenic amines. We're going to talk about the endolamine neurotransmitter, serotonin, today. And although in the neurosciences, most people don't really think of it this way, it's really more important as a peripheral neurotransmitter than in the central nervous system. Only about 5% of the serotonin in your body is in the brain. 95% of it is out, particularly in the bowels and in the vascular system. Its name, serotonin, gives you some hint to that. It comes from serum and tone. It was first discovered back in the late 1940s, peripherally, and only about a decade later in the nervous system. It really has two primary sources, peripherally, from what are called the enterochromaffin cells in the intestines. Enterochromaffin cells, which actually helps you move things through your digestive system, enhances intestinal motility, smooth muscle contractions. And blood vessels, the primary sources from platelets, blood platelets. What else do platelets do? Blood clotting or coagulation of the blood. They're also important in vasoconstriction. They act through different receptor families. We're going to come back to different receptor families later on. But in the bowel, largely 5-HT4s. And in the blood vessels, largely 5-HT1Ds. So the primary sources outside the nervous system are not from neurons. But that's most of the serotonin in your body. So we're going to spend the rest of the time talking about the 5% inside the brain. That less than 500 micrograms total that actually helps create the world as we see it and as we experience it. Now, within the central nervous system, the nuclei that generate serotonin are called the RAFE nuclei. And as you can see, they're extensively distributed through the brainstem and the midbrain. A large number of different nuclei that we call the RAFE nuclei. There are additionally some serotonergic nuclei within the retina. But we're going to concentrate on those within the central nervous system. Unlike the noradrenergic system, which had the A nomenclature, these are called the B nuclei. B, not A. For simplicity's sake, most people concentrate on two primary groups of RAFE nuclei. A dorsal group that lies right below the fourth ventricle in the midbrain. The dorsal RAFE nuclei, they're bilaterally distributed. And then a median group, or a medial group, that lies ventral to the dorsal nuclei, called the median RAFE nuclei. Again, bilaterally distributed, further away from the ventricle. Okay. And what were the primary output neurons for cerebral cortex? Anybody remember those? What kind of neurons are the primary output neurons from cerebral cortex? Pyramidal neurons. Okay, how about from hippocampus? Anybody remember there? CA1, but what kind of neurons are they? Pyramidal neurons again. This is the other major region in the nervous system where we find pyramidal neurons, the RAFE nuclei. They look and act an awful lot like pyramidal neurons in cortical structures. They fire action potentials and have large after hyperpolarizations that are sensitive to blockers for slow AHPs and AHP currents. And like pyramidal neurons in other portions of the brain. What distinguishes them is their biosynthetic enzymes for for the neurotransmitters that they produce. Unlike other pyramidal neuron populations, which release glutamate as their transmitter, these release serotonin, not glutamate. Otherwise, they're very typical pyramidal neurons, way down in the midbrain and brainstem. Turn off the light just for a second here. Maybe. This is the axon branching pattern of a single raphe nucleus neuron from the dorsal set of nuclei. Very, very large pattern of neurons that it contacts. An area spanning several millimeters in extent from one neuron down in the raphe. And that's fairly characteristic of the pattern of axonal branching from the dorsal nucleus. Very diffuse outputs, blanketing large sections of the target areas in cortex, in the diencephalon, the thalamus, even in midbrain, in the hypothalamus as well. That's as opposed to the pattern of outputs coming from the median raphe, a deeper group of nuclei, which tends to be very specific in its pattern. Related sets of cortical columns, for instance, will be hit by the same raphe nucleus neuron, and adjacent columns will not. Repeating units of pyramidal neurons in the hippocampus will be hit by the same raphe nucleus neuron, and neighbors will not. So we think of this as a nonspecific pathway from the dorsal raphe and a very specific pathway from the median raphe. Two different patterns or uses of serotonin, one quite specific, one more general or diffuse. Now, when we talk about different neurotransmitters, we have to do a little biochemistry. So we have to talk about the production and the breakdown of these transmitters. Biosynthesis first, and then metabolism second. So we begin with an amino acid, tryptophan. Anybody ever consume any tryptophan?
Yep.
It's found in all sorts of food sources. It's acted upon by the rate-limiting enzyme for production of serotonin, which is called tryptophan hydroxylase. We had another rate-limiting enzyme earlier. What was that called?
Tyrosine
hydroxylase for catecholamine synthesis. This one is similarly regulated, but so far we've only found three phosphorylation sites on it, not four. So the substrate is tryptophan, the enzyme is tryptophan hydroxylase. The product is tryptamine, another amino acid, but it doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier as well. Tryptophan crosses it very readily. Okay, this product, tryptamine, is acted upon by another enzyme that we've seen previously, AAADC, alpha aromatic amino acid decarboxylase. What was the other name for AAADC? DDC, which was the wrong name, we learned. So it doesn't act just on catecholamines or DOPA. It has other amino acids as a substrate. When it acts upon tryptamine, it produces as its product the neurotransmitter, serotonin, or 5-hydroxytryptamine. If you were ever wondering why serotonin was abbreviated 5-HT, that's why, 5-hydroxytryptamine. Okay. So again, we start with the amino acid, tryptophan, backed on it by the rate-limiting enzyme to produce this precursor, tryptamine. Tryptamine is acted upon by AAADC to produce the neurotransmitter, serotonin. Okay? So that's the biosynthetic pathway. Now, for breakdown of serotonin, we've already learned about this pathway, monoamine oxidases. And which one was specific for it? MAOAs. Okay. What was the mnemonic about MAOBs?
They work on things
that have A in their abbreviation. Okay, does serotonin or 5-HT have an A in its abbreviation?
Yeah.
So it must be MAOAs. MAOA acts upon serotonin, breaks it down into an aldehyde intermediate. Don't really care if you learn the full name of the intermediate, but knowing it's an aldehyde is useful because it is then acted upon by aldehyde dehydrogenase. Aldehyde dehydrogenase. Again, what do aldehydes often do to you? Cause a hangover sort of feeling. Okay, a sore head. The aldehyde dehydrogenase converts this aldehyde into 5-HIAA. 5-HIAA, or 5-hydroxyindole acetate, or indole acetic acid if you prefer the American pronunciation. 5-HIAA isn't all that much easier to spell. So we begin with serotonin. It's broken down by an MAO into an aldehyde intermediate. The aldehyde is then broken down by aldehyde dehydrogenase, or AD, into the final product, 5-HIAA. Okay. So that's biosynthesis and degradation of serotonin. Questions on those biochemical pathways? If you look over at the right-hand side, there are some drugs that are actually used out there in the wild, clinically or elsewise. This first one, fenfluramine, is a good blocker for the rate-limiting enzyme. Fenfluramine. In the 1980s, 1990s, and up to about 2002, it was extremely widely marketed. To buy it in any drugstore in the country, find it by the cash register in most gas stations. Fenfluramine. Anybody ever heard of it? It's been banned from the market now for over 9 years. Well, not so much an upper for truckers, a diet pill it was called. But given that it was in gas stations, you know, if it was labeled as a diet pill, truck drivers assumed that it might have amphetamine-like effects. Didn't. Did help people lose weight tremendously by blocking a specific enzyme pathway and preventing production of less of an appetite. Okay. Unfortunately, it had major effects on the cardiovascular system. People started dying of heart attacks. Since it wasn't being marketed as a drug per se, it was being marketed as a supplement. It took the FDA a while to tighten up their regulation of it. There were several hundred reported cases of people taking fenfluramine on a daily basis that had coronaries and died. That probably means there were lots more than several hundred. Fenfluramine, in fact, does not just block the enzyme for biosynthesis. It also blocks transporters, both the vesicular transporter and the cell membrane or synaptic transporter. These are called SERTs again for serotonin reuptake transporters. We had NETs and DATs earlier. These are SERTs. Sounds like a breath mint, but with an S. Okay. And fenfluramine went from being a widely popular drug, made the cover of Time magazine several times, things like that, to a pariah drug in a fairly short period of time. Okay. Let's cover the transporters for just a moment. The vesicular one is proton dependent, so it requires an ATPase, to pump the protons into the vesicle, because the proton has to be on the inside of the membrane for the transporter to work to bring serotonin across to the inside. They're exchanged with one another. So ATPases use what as their substrate? ATP. Okay. The synaptic transporter is sodium and chloride dependent. Have we seen sodium and chloride dependent transporters before?
Yes.
Like for
dopamine.
Dopamine, it's a good example. Okay. So fenfluramine can block both of those types of transporters. Fenfluramine, unfortunately, was not the only drug over there on the side chart. You're in luck, though, because you know many of them beforehand. What's a good blocker for AAADC?
Carbidopa.
Carbidopa. We've talked about carbidopa before. Does carbidopa cross the blood-brain barrier?
No.
No. Okay. How about, do we know any drugs that would block MAOs? MAO inhibitors. Okay. For MAOAs, are they all reversible or irreversible or both?
Both.
It's the only category of MAO inhibitors that you could answer both. Okay. Could you use a generic MAO inhibitor that blocks A's or B's?
Yes.
You could still, if it's a generic one that blocks both, it would still block MAOAs. So you have a list of at least three different drugs that you should have learned by now, right? That could serve to block this important biosynthetic enzyme. I'm sorry, not biosynthetic, but degradatory enzyme. Okay. If you wanted a drug to block the aldehyde dehydrogenase, maybe you were a CIA interrogator and wanted somebody to feel really bad, build up lots of aldehydes in their system. You could give them a drug like disulfiram. Disulfiram to block the aldehyde dehydrogenase. Bartenders probably wouldn't be in favor of a drug like that. Okay. So there are a number of different relevant drugs for blocking this biosynthetic and degradation pathway. And everybody by now has learned the lesson that you should be learning drugs, right?
Right.
Not taking drugs. The state of Texas frowns on that. But learning drugs. All right, we've seen this chart before. Should be much less panic involved at this point in time. We're going to concentrate on the right-hand column over here. Drugs that block the synaptic reuptake mechanisms, the SERTs. What's a name for drugs that very specifically block just serotonin reuptake?
SSRIs.
Why are they called SSRIs?
Selective serotonin.
Serotonin-specific reuptake inhibitors. S for serotonin, S for specific, R for reuptake, I for inhibitors. SSRIs. Very popular, very lucrative category of drugs for drug companies. So, of course, when we start at the top, we've got drugs that block all of these biogenic amine reuptake mechanisms. And again, you're not going to get a prescription for cocaine. We're going to get down to the specific ones for serotonin in a moment. We've got the ones that are cross-reactive for both norepinephrine and serotonin. We've talked about those previously. Okay. Then we've got the category of SSRIs. It's not as clear-cut as what the marketing literature suggests. They do tend to have a little cross-reactivity with the other transporters, but they're mostly specific for serotonin. The one that's most widely known and still widely used, fluoxetine. Fluoxetine, which is marketed as Prozac. It's off-patent. You can get generic forms of that now, but they've patented time-released versions of it. and different color schemes for it. The latest color scheme is pink. We tried it with different smiley faces on the pills as well.
What?
Literally. Anybody know which of our former presidents took Prozac on a daily basis? All of them. Not that we'll admit to it. The older of the George Bushes that the tollway that's real close by campus is named for. He's a regular George user.
Herbert.
Yep, George Herbert Walker Bush was a regular Prozac user. He experienced one of the nasty side effects of the drug as well.
Erectile dysfunction.
No, not erectile dysfunction. At least if he did, he did not report that. Nope. The other major side effect that people worry about is the emetic reflex.
Oh, the
vomiting. Yes, he vomited on the Prime Minister of Japan at a state dinner. And they had trotted pharmacologists out to blame it on the drug. Besides Prozac or fluoxetine, we have sertraline, marketed as Zoloft, citalopram. And then the category of drugs that are more commonly prescribed, not for antidepressant treatment, but for treatment of obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD, drugs like paroxetine and fluvoxamine. So if you notice, this chart has a lot of drugs on it. Drug companies have been incredibly busy coming up with compounds in this category. A huge number of prescriptions are written on a daily and annual basis. Yes?
Could you explain the difference between Lexapro and Celexa?
It depends on the individual. It's probably the shortest answer.
What the molecule is
like? No, in terms of its effect.
I was just wondering how the molecules were different.
Completely. Is that a simple enough answer? What do you have a specific in mind for your question?
No, I heard like Lexapro being touted as the cleaner version.
A lot of that tends to be sort of marketing hype more than reality. Depends on who's doing the experiment sometimes as well.
Yeah.
And drug companies keep most of that proprietary and then just show the parts that they like people to see.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, how many kinds of serotonin receptors are there? Way too many. Unfortunately, you have an exam coming up. Take advantage of many useful findings from psychology, the recency effect. This will be one of the more recent things that you've studied, so that may help you remember it a little better than otherwise. There are 7 major families of serotonin receptors. That's worse than any of the others we've seen so far. Unfortunately, it's becoming critically important to subdivide some of those down into the A's, B's, C's, and D's as well. I'm going to try to hold that at a minimum, but to deal with what we know in neuroscience these days, we're going to have to break some of them down into smaller categories than these 7. So pay attention when I tell you this is an important one to know about, okay? To make matters even worse, we've been talking mostly about metabotropic receptors lately, right? 7 transmembrane segment type receptors that are linked to G proteins. Well, one of the categories of serotonin receptors doesn't fit into that model. It's a cationic channel, selected for positively charged ions. That's the 5-HT3 receptors that we'll talk about in a few minutes. All the rest, 5-HT1, 2, 4, 5, 6, and 7, are metabotropic receptors. So are you all ready for it? Okay. Start with 5-HT1s. So far, they have been subdivided into five different categories. I don't want you to learn all five. Okay? Let's start with the generic 5-HT1 category or family. They're all tied to GIs. All tied to GIs. What would that do to PKC activity?
Nothing.
Absolutely nothing. What enzyme, what kinase should be affected by GIs? PKA. Should it upregulate PKA or downregulate it?
Down.
The I stands for?
Inhibit.
Okay. Again, you need to have this in mind.
For GIs, aren't there two alpha subunits?
Aren't there two alpha subunits?
GIIs and then the GIOs, and GIO affects PLC.
And this is just the GIs,
okay.
not the mix.
Okay.
So yes, you're right, and we'll see a bad example of that in a little bit. But for this, we're talking just about the GIs, which is limited just to the effect on adenylate cyclase. Okay? All right. Now, is this a term we've heard before?
Yes.
Autoreceptor. Okay? Most of you, or many of you, work in laboratories, so you may be dealing with species that we consider rodents. Fortunately, all of you fall in the category of humans as well. Turns out there are two different gene families coding for the autoreceptors. Humans, it's the 5-HT1Ds. In non-primate species, it's 5-HT1Bs. Different protein, different gene. It's one thing that makes us different from rats. We have a different autoreceptor. I think there's more than just that that makes us different. These are the autoreceptors. What do autoreceptors do? They regulate the release of the neurotransmitter itself. Okay, this violates the rule of it being a 2. It's the 5-HT1s, either B or D, depending on the species. We have 1As as well, and then we have a lot of other categories. All of these are agonized by serotonin. Is that an endogenous or exogenous agonist? It's the endogenous one that we produce and package up in vesicles. An exogenous agonist for all of these is a drug we're going to see a lot of times today, quipazine. Quipazine. It's a very good, very potent serotonin agonist. We're going to see it across most of the categories today. Quipazine. Okay. Then we have drugs that are more specific. And for today, I think if we concentrate just on the 1As and on the autoreceptors, that'll be difficult enough. A selective agonist for 1As, a drug like Buspro. Buspro. Maybe you can remember it because it sounds like it starts with a bus. As opposed to drugs that fall into an older category, these have been drugs that have been used for over a century now. The old prototype was a drug called ergotamine. Ergotamine. Not much used these days, because it has the unfortunate side effect of things like hallucinations.
Related to LSD?
Definitely related to LSD. So more commonly these days, synthetic drugs like sumatriptan are used. In fact, any drug that has this suffix, triptan, it's an autoreceptor targeted drug. Sumatriptan. Best evidence looks like the autoreceptor effects are mediated not by the alpha subunits. What's the other active portion of G proteins? The beta gamma subunits. Again, downregulating voltage dependent calcium channel activity presynaptically. If we want a drug to block selectively these different types of receptors for the 5-HT1s, we've seen this drug before? Spipirone.
Yeah.
Is it bound to lots of other receptors we've seen before? It's not a really clean selective drug. You want one to block the autoreceptors, something like isomaltane. Isomaltane. Or if you just want to block all of the 5-HT1 receptors, the ones tied to GIs, you would use a drug like pendolol. Pendolol. And I think for now you can safely ignore the other categories, unless you're going to become a specialist in serotonin receptors. So again, which are your autoreceptors? 1Ds. And how about in a lab rat? 1Bs. Okay. Turns out the 1As are a useful category of drugs. Number of prescriptions for anxiolytic treatment, people receive buspirone, or buspirone, if you prefer that pronunciation, for treatment of anxiety. 5-HT1A agonist. The autoreceptor is targeted specifically, primarily for its peripheral effects. If you suffer from migraines, excessive vasoconstriction, treatment with 1B or 1D agonists. In the old days, that used to mean derivatives of ergotamine. These days, that means drugs with the triptan suffix. Sumatriptan being the one that's most widely marketed. Sumatriptan. To agonize the autoreceptors, to cut down on effects of serotonin there. Also cuts down on the vasoconstriction in the peripheral blood vessels. Any students of World War II history here? These were the favorite migraine treatments that the Nazi Party used in Germany in World War II. Anybody in charge of Germany in World War II?
Yeah.
What was his name?
Hitler.
He took these drugs regularly. They worked for his migraines. They also have major psychoactive effects.
Does it cause psychosis?
That's part of the reason why the FDA doesn't let you prescribe them any longer. Yes, sir. They try pretty much anything until they find one that's effective. These days, most people start with that last category of drugs, so. All right, that was 5-HT1s. Now we have 5-HT2s. Remember, we've only got 7 to go through. Let's start with the sort of generic information. There's 3 different categories here. And unfortunately, you need to learn all 3 of these. They all act through a GQ. They all act through a GQ. So what would GQs do to pKa activity? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. What enzyme is activated by the alpha subunit of GQs? Phospholipase C. So what's the substrate for that? PIP2, and there's two products. IP3 and diacylglycerol. Which one is membrane bound? DAG. Which one has its own receptors found on the endoplasmic reticulum? IP3. And what's released through those receptors?
Calcium.
Okay. And do we have any calcium-dependent protein kinases?
Yes.
We talked about two of them, PKC, and also one that starts with C, CAMK2. Okay. So they could be influenced by this pathway. All right, the endogenous agonist for all of the 5-HT2s, again, is serotonin. Also this drug we saw previously, quipizine. It's a good exogenous agonist. This one, though, also, remember false transmitters for catecholamine? Turns out these are perfectly fine with those. So alpha-methyl serotonin, perfectly good transmitter. Activates all the 5-HT2 receptors. Not any of the other types, just 5-HT2s. Now let's get into why we need to know about 2As, 2Bs, and 2Cs. These are drugs that it is extremely illegal for you to possess. But they've been widely studied and widely used. Drugs like lysergic acid diethylamide, LSD. Psilocin, which is the active metabolite of something that's contained in a variety of different psilocybin mushrooms, which grow native in this area. I have seen them growing on campus.
Thank you.
I'm going to tell you where or the conditions under which they do, though. They are partial agonists for 5-HT2As and 2Cs. 2As and 2Cs. Other drugs that we talked about last time, the so-called psychedelic phenethylamines, which if you'll remember included things like this cactus, mescaline, things that were in nutmeg, tree bark, yohimbine. Those also bind to and act as partial agonists for 5-HT2As, but not Cs. That began to give people clues to which of these were the so-called psychedelic or hallucinogenic serotonin receptors. Turns out we make our own agonist selective for these hallucinatory receptors. One we make is called DMT, dimethyltryptamine. Dimethyltryptamine. Its binding affinity is very similar to the most potent of these, LSD, but it acts as a full agonist there. A number of others have been illicitly marketed as hallucinogens, DOI, DOB, DOM. But DMT is one that we produce ourselves. In fact, our brain does not function well without DMT production. We seem to depend on it to sustain what we call reality, because our nervous system really does not feed us a very complete view of reality. So we make it up as we go along. Sometimes the trouble emerges when you make up a little too much. Then we tend to categorize that as psychosis. There's a wide and growing category of drugs that are selective for blocking 5-HT2A receptors. The one that's most widely known is this drug, ketanserin. Ketanserin, it's a selective antagonist for 5-HT2As. If you wanted to block the other ones, you could use drugs like mitergiline. Mitergiline will block 2Bs, or ritanserin or methyl sergide, which is a much older drug, would block 2Cs. If you wanted to block all of them, and typically then you end up with somebody that's very depressed, drugs like mesylsergine or dibenzoline. Mesylsergine or dibenzoline. Those are also stocked by a number of emergency rooms for people that have come in and taken a little too much of some of the agonist drugs. Again, what G protein do they act through? GQs. And that's different from most of the other receptors that are implicated in the psychotropic effects. Many of the others act through GIs. So the best available evidence we have these days that effects like the triple rainbow guy observed are mediated by 5-HT2A receptors. Very complicated looking graph. The lower data you are on the graph, the smaller the quantity of drug you need to saturate receptors in any category. This is the typical dose that a human subject ingests of LSD to trip, to hallucinate. Very low dose. So any receptor category falling below that line has the proper affinity to give the observed effects. So essentially, you can ignore all the drugs that are way above this line. So then if you go in with selective antagonists for drugs that are below that line, the only category of drugs that if you don't block it and block all the others, you still have this effect, 5-HT2As. If you block just 5-HT2As and none of the others, you lose that effect. Pretty good evidence that that is the mechanism of action. Not for the side effects, not for the pounding pulse, dry mouth, changes in blood pressure, all the others, but for the psychotropic effects, 5-HT2As. And there's a pretty good experimental literature on that, but again, you're not going to get a prescription for any drugs in that category. Perhaps for antagonists, but not for partial agonists or full agonists. But then again, you produce your own. They haven't managed to make that illegal yet. Probably not going to. Don't tell any Tea Party members about it, though. So we talk about categories of drugs that act upon the 5-HT2A receptors and have that psychotropic effect in dopaminergic psychedelic drugs. Again, we make our own DMT. It's produced by neurons in multiple regions of the nervous system. Another good reason for not licking toads, and you know, dogs seem to be the ones that favor this in the state of Texas. Will be found in very unusual states, I guess of mind, you could say, for the dog, after licking certain toads that secrete bufotenin from their skin. Of course, multiple different forms of this drug have been marketed. None of them legal any longer. And this one is a plant-derived compound. It's an active metabolite of the compound that's most prevalent in those mushrooms, psilocin. And what's the name that people like to call those these days? Magic mushrooms. Why are they called magic mushrooms?
Because they're magic.
Because they're magic, huh? They make you think you're Harry Potter, huh? Okay. Again, any of the drugs that have similar effects bind very promiscuously. They don't just bind just to the 5-HT2A receptors. They have cross-reactivity with the alpha-2 receptors and with the D2 receptors, which explains many of their other physiological effects. DMT doesn't have that cross-reactivity. Primarily binds just to serotonin receptors. So the one we make ourselves is much more specific than exogenous compounds. And I think we'll skip the history lesson on all of this as well. There are potential clinical uses of drugs that interact with 5-HT2 ligands, or receptors, sorry. For treatment of schizophrenia, antagonists have been gone through clinical trials now. Antagonists for 5-HT2A receptors. Trouble is finding the appropriate dose. You don't want to shut them down completely. You would just like to down-regulate their activity in some people. Potential problem is that they might then be used on wider populations, kind of dull them down. Wouldn't be particularly friendly if, for instance, you were required to take a 5-HT2A antagonist as a condition of being able to be a student. People wouldn't laugh very much any longer. But then again, they'd probably be more docile. (laughs) 5-HT2C agonists are under wine study right now as potential diet pills. If you inject a drug like agomelatine, which is a 5-HT2C agonist, agomelatine, into the feeding centers in the hypothalamus, like the ventromedial or lateral hypothalamus, animals stop eating. It's been difficult to find 5-HT2C agonists that cross the blood-brain barrier, but there are a couple proprietary ones right now, and they probably will come to market for control of appetite. They have huge long letter number combinations right now. And I'm sure they will have much marketable names, much more marketable names by the time they get to that stage. So there is reason to pay attention to this category of drugs other than for the psychological effects. All right, so we did ones and twos. What comes next? Three, everybody passed kindergarten. 5-HT3s were the exception. They're not metabotropic receptors. They're cation channels. They are pentameric. Have we seen any other pentameric ligand-gated ion channels? Like GABA-A receptors, perhaps, or GABA-C receptors, many others. They are what we would call heteropentamers, because there are two different types of subunits, 5-HT3As and 3Bs. So most of them that are expressed have one or more of each of those subunits. Heteropentamers. The endogenous ligand for 5-HT3 receptors is serotonin. And have we seen this drug before? Quipazine, again, a good agonist. Have we seen this drug before? Methyl serotonin. In this case, it's an agonist again. or another drug called CBG. CBG, 5-HT3 agonist. The ones that are more relevant clinically than that, though, are the antagonists. Drugs that have this suffix, Cetron. The one that's probably best to know is ondansetron. Something dancing on the Cetron. Ondansetron. But any of these Cetron drugs are antagonists for the 5-HT3s. This one doesn't follow that naming rule. Zacapride, but a lot of prescriptions are written for that too. Different drug company involved. Probably there was a patent fight involved, so the different name. Zacapride. Maybe that's why the pride suffix is in there. Zacapride. Again, it's a pentameric cation channel, not a metabotropic mechanism. And it's weakly selective for sodium ions. It does also allow other cations to pass. What might that be? Potassium? Calcium? How about magnesium? Even magnesium. Any cation could potentially be gated by this channel. What do we have the most of outside a neuron? We have the most of the sodium, probably, and also potassium. But what's the highest concentration gradient?
Calcium.
For calcium. So even though it's somewhat selective for sodium, they often carry a significant calcium current as well. Can calcium do anything metabotropically in cells? As a secondary effect, lots of enzymes are sensitive to calcium. Okay. Why is it useful to learn those Cetron drugs or Zacapride? Well, they're mostly used as anti-emetics. Anyone here ever been seasick or car sick or dizzy for any reason? This could be a category of drug you'd use for that. Probably you wouldn't, though, because these are very expensive drugs right now. Again, that pride suffix in there gives you some clue. There's been a lot of lawyers involved in the development of these drugs. A lot of money has gone towards legal defenses. But they're widely used as an adjunct in chemotherapy. What's the basic purpose of most agents that are used as chemotherapy agents? To stop cell division. Any rapidly dividing cells or die. That applies to things like cancer cells. But do you have any other rapidly dividing cells in your body? Like? Pardon? All the lining of your GI system. And it turns over all the time. Would that make you perhaps nauseous if they all died? So, having drugs that can help deal with that is beneficial. Daily cost of treatments like this, several hundred dollars very often. Are there any other anti-emetic agents available? Such as? Imitrol, not very effective in these cases. How about one that again is extremely illegal in the state of Texas, but if you were a chemotherapy patient in California, you could obtain? Medical marijuana. We'll come back to that later in the semester after this exam. Equally effective with these, do you think it costs hundreds of dollars a day? Depends. Depends on where you buy it from or how much you consume. The medically effective dose, though, doesn't cost hundreds of dollars a day. Okay. Can't obtain it in most states, and it's still illegal under U.S. federal law. It's not currently being enforced in most states, the federal law. But the state law and local laws very much are. Not going to ask for a show of hands if anybody suffers from IBS. irritable bowel syndrome. But again, some of these Cetrons are marketed for treatment of that as well. I don't think people want to talk about it if they have to deal with that. Turns out that these Cetron drugs are also extremely potent nootropic drugs. They enhance learning and memory. Unlike the medical marijuana that we were talking about earlier, which probably actually disrupts learning and memory. At least if you ingested hundreds of dollars worth per day, pretty much guaranteed that would disrupt. So if you had hundreds of dollars per dose to be studied with, this might be a category of drugs that might have some utility. There are, thankfully, much cheaper drugs that also have nootropic effects. Again, these are antagonist drugs, the Cetrons, for 5-HT3 receptors. All right, we've gotten up to three. What comes next?
Seven?
That'd be a good guess. We can short-circuit things here a little bit. The four like effects. Okay, so obviously if it's four like, 5-HT4s must be in the list. Unfortunately, it's not a logical list. It's not 4, 5, and 6. It's 4, 6, and 7. So what have we left out so far? Fives. We're going to come to fives last. Okay. The 5-HT4-like drugs all act through GSs. So what would an agonist for them do to pKa activity? Increase it or stimulate it. That's what the S stands for. Again, the endogenous agonist for all of them is serotonin. A good exogenous agonist is quipazine. Any category of these deal with any drugs that we've seen elsewhere? Yeah, unfortunately, 5-HT6s. Some of the hallucinogens are partial agonists for. But you can block these and not block the hallucinogenic effect. So again, this is mediating presumably some of the side effects. Some of the other hallucinogens are partial agonists for the 5-HT7s. I think I'm going to spare everybody from learning the selective agonists. So you don't need to learn the selective agonist this time. If you know the generic agonist for all of them, that's sufficient. Unfortunately, there isn't a generic antagonist that affects all of them. So the one that does the last two, the sixes and sevens, is the drug clozapine. Clozapine. And I think I'll spare you from learning the one that's just specific for sixes. So clozapine blocks 5-HT6s and 7s, but it doesn't have much effect on 5-HT5s. There isn't a generic for all of these 5-HT4-like receptors. Clinically, we haven't found very good uses for these drugs. They're helpful for blood pressure problems, for gastric motility problems, for some people. Some of them, the 5-HT4s particularly, are useful. Others don't respond to them well at all. So rather than present the very cloudy clinical picture right now, I'm going to say, how many of you are going on to medical school? Got to pass this next exam first. Come on, I usually get a higher show of hands than that. You're not certain you're going to pass this next exam? Those of you that plan on going on, you're going to need to know more about differentiating drugs in this category. But for now, since the picture is so muddy, I think this is more than enough about that. What's the last variety of serotonin receptors? 5-HT5s. And again, it's a mess. It's got fewer question marks now than it did even a year ago. Okay. Notice even the name is a little funny. People don't even capitalize the name. We know that serotonin binds to it as an agonist, but it looks like lysergic acid does as well as a full agonist, not partial. Not quipazine. This is the one that quipazine does not interact with. Instead, there's another drug that's often used. The abbreviation is COAT. Notice I don't have it in color for the good reason that it not only binds to these five, but also a variety of the ones, such as 1A, B, and D, the autoreceptors, and also 5-HT7s. In fact, it looks like a number of other non-traditional transmitters bind to these receptors as well. Peptides of various sorts. There's some evidence that dopamine may interact with these as well. So if there's lots of question marks, that means not very much you need to know. There is one, actually two relevant pieces of information. They act through members of the GI family. So that goes back to your earlier question. Not just GIs, but also GOs. Okay? So that inhibitory effect on adenylate cyclase could be just one of several effects. There is a drug that does seem to have some specificity, but it's only a partial agonist. Valerenic acid. Valerenic acid or vanerylate. Part of the reason we don't know much about these are really rare receptors. They're not found in many types of neurons, and they're not highly expressed even in them. So there is no good model system for studying them. You really have to be a glutton for punishment to make that your career field. Not something I'd suggest to anybody sitting here today. Is there anything else relevant about serotonin? One more. It's a precursor for production of another important neuroactive peptide. Not peptide, small amino acid related compound. Melatonin. Is there any daily cycle that melatonin plays some role in? Your sleep-waking cycle. Okay, everybody knows that light comes into your head through the eyeballs, eventually causes firing of the ganglion cells in the retina, and that one of the minor pathways from the retina goes to the suprachiasmatic nucleus, lies right above the optic chiasm. And that then sends a projection to the habenula. Anyone heard of the habenula before? What was its primary transmitter? Acetylcholine. And it projects to its next door neighbor, this little white fuzzy looking structure here right in front of the right behind the ventricle, the pineal gland. The reason it's white and fuzzy, this is probably how it appears in most of your brains. It begins to calcify at puberty, and it increasingly calcifies as you get older. Different rates for different folks. It has been associated with sleep cycle disturbances. People that have a lot of trouble sleeping, theirs is probably more calcified than those that don't. Pineal gland uses serotonin as its substrate, and I don't expect you to learn this whole biosynthetic pathway, again, unless you're going to specialize in melatonin. But it's a two-step process to go from serotonin to melatonin. Melatonin. Now, this is dead in the center of the brain. is the pineal a neural structure? It receives inputs from neurons. But does it synapse with neurons? Does it synapse with muscle cells? They're not considered neurons. It dumps its melatonin out into the ventricle. So it eventually has access not only to the entire brain, but to the entire body. Melatonin. You might know when you typically have the highest peak of melatonin production daily. Well, it depends on when you go to sleep. For people that sleep semi-normal hours, they go to bed around midnight or slightly before, it might be around 3 a.m. It's also the point in time when your body temperature reaches its lowest level. And that's actually a better indicator, because some people like to go to sleep at 6 at night, or 6 in the morning, or some random time. And when their body temperature hits its lowest, that's typically when melatonin production is its highest. Your body temperature, your core temperature could drop by about a half a degree at that point in time. Your skin surface temperature might drop by a degree and a half or 2 degrees at that point in time. Okay. Anything else relevant about melatonin, or not melatonin, serotonin? We talked about anything that could kill neurons before for other transmitter systems. Neurotoxins. There is a serotonin-specific neurotoxin as well. It will selectively kill just serotonin-producing neurons. That is the compound PCPA. Not to be confused with PCP. PCPA. Parachlorophenylalanine. PCPA. Selectively taken up by serotonin-synthesizing neurons. Gets into the mitochondria and kills them dead very rapidly. Serotonin-specific neurotoxin, PCPA. All right, is that enough for today, you think?
Yes.
I think so, too.